Hello friends, I'm your host Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. And we're both published by the same wonderful publisher, Blacksmith Books.
Okay.
Hong Kong. Shall we say hello to Pete?
Yeah, hello, Pete. Is he there? Coming?
No, but Pete Spurrier should get a shout out because Pete's the proprietor of Blacksmith Books in Hong Kong, and he's brought many, he's given the chance to many authors such as myself who have wonderful stories to tell. Mainly based in Asia, aren't they? And it's a difficult, I don't know if you found this, but the publishing world, it's quite difficult to get a contract. But Pete will just look at a story, and if he thinks it's got merit, if he thinks people will enjoy it, and if he thinks it brings a benefit to Hong Kong or Asian nonfiction, then he gives you a chance. And
he's a nice guy.
Yes. So hello, Pete. And thank you for all your authors. So, is Hong Kong hot at the moment, Tim?
Yeah, it's very hot. It's 33. But last 2 weeks was okay because there was raining continuously. But now it's hot again. It's 33, 34 degrees. So you know how it is.
Yeah, the rainy season in Hong Kong is just, it's insane, isn't it? It just doesn't stop raining. Yeah. And yet it's still quite hot, or at least for us Europeans, it's still really hot. Which part of Hong Kong do you live in?
I live in Kowloon side. We live this side here.
Do you know Mong Kok?
Oh yeah. I have been in Hong Kong from 1980s.
You know it all, yeah. I lived in Mong Kok for about 8 months. Then I moved to Wan Chai, working in the nightclubs, and that's another story. But we're here today to talk about a fascinating subject, particularly fascinating to anyone that's got an interest in the military, and that is our wonderful Gurkhas. But I shouldn't say our wonderful Gurkhas, because the Gurkhas serve the United Kingdom, the Indian Army, and also the Nepalese Army. Am I correct in that, Tim?
Yeah, Nepalese Army is the original one. So both Indian Army and the British Army was, of course, started by the British. So they just separated after 1947 when India got independence and divided the Gurkha Brigade between themselves. And the institution has been continuing as of today for over 206 years now.
Yes, and a very proud history, we should say. Your book, it's very comprehensive. Has it been well received?
Yeah, the main reason I wrote this book was because, for the last 206 years, all the books written in the about the Gurkhas was mostly written from outside. There wasn't even one single book. Of course, there was two or three, few of them in Nepalese language, but not in English. So when I realized that there was a need for that, then I started working on it, because when you have the book written from only one side, it becomes one-sided, because it's only tells one side of the story from the outsider, not from the actual side of our side of the story. Then I realized that was the most important part of the reason why I have written this book. And actually, I did a lot of research. I worked almost 3 years on the book, visited many places like the UK, Burma, Singapore, Malaysia, and Hong Kong, I know by heart. And I even went to Nepal for two times and visited from the east part of Nepal to the west part of Nepal, and went through all the those area where all those Gurkhas were, and tried to get their story and put it into the book, because I thought that it was imperative to put our side of the story that unfortunately hasn't been told until now, you know. So that's what I thought then. That's what I did for the last 3.5 years.
Yes, and you've done a great job. Because traditionally, the Gurkhas have had, let's just say, talk about the British Gurkhas. They have a British officer. And whenever I see the Gurkhas talked about in the media, it tends to be the officer, the British officer, who is speaking. So I guess your book is giving the voice to the actual riflemen themselves. Is that fair to say?
I think, you know, it has been over 1.5 year now since the book is published. Because my book is not only published by Pete, but also published by Penguin in Southeast Asia for those Malaysia, Singapore area. Also by Western Book in South Asia. And we're also the Blacksmith Book one is the third one. So this is the first one published by Penguin. And this is the second one published by for the South Asia market. And the Blacksmith, the one was the third one we did for the international edition. And we're also having the Nepali edition is also coming very soon. So the book has was well received from all over the world, especially now it's available everywhere. And mostly it was an eye-opener for our people, the Gurkhas. Not only the Gurkhas, but also the Nepalese people as a whole. Because until now, there wasn't a book, as I said before, that covers almost complete history of the Gurkhas, already in brief. I know it's a long institution, over 270 years old, and it's almost impossible to combine in one book, right? So at least what I did was to give a brief detail from the start to 2018. So at least people have a general idea of the Gurkhas. Because until now, since the book is mostly written from our side, it's all about the bravery, how brave they are, how good they are, how loyal they are, and that's all. But the Gurkha story is not only about bravery, it's also about tragedy, So that's what I was trying to put in, and it has been very well received all over the world. And I'm very happy that after 200 years, I happened to be the first person who got to write that book, and I'm honored as well. So we're doing very well.
Yes, you've done the Gurkha regiments proud, definitely. And you yourself, Tim, was it 12 years you served?
No, I did 13 years. I joined the, actually I am the, as you know, those who knows about the Gurkhas, they are mostly, before the World War II, all the Nepalese could join were allowed to join the British India, British Gurkha in India. But after the World War II, mostly from the British side, they kind of selected, made a different, call it, there's only 4 tribes of peoples from Nepal, they were allowed to join in the army, and they call it the martial races. So that is, and they were divided from 2 part of Nepal, eastern part of Nepal and western part of Nepal. From western part of come Magar and Gurung, like myself, and the eastern part come Raja and Limbu. So after the World War II, most Gurkhas were from those tribes. So I came from, I come from the Midwestern part of Nepal, which is the heartbeat of the Gurkha. So every village there is a Gurung village. So you mean it's a Gurkha village. You can call it a Gurkha village. So as a Gurkha, there wasn't a single family, that has no connection whatsoever, no connection with the British, you know. So as a Gorkha children, we grew up dreaming about becoming a Gorkha, because that was the only thing we saw, we were taught, you know. So even if we were very good at school, we still, because our last destination was always there. So like my grandfathers, my father, my uncles, I was no exception. So I joined the army in 1980, then came to Hong Kong, then I retired at 1993 as an army corporal, because there was a rundown coming on because the Hong Kong was going back to China. At the same time, I also felt honestly that I wasn't cut out for the army, so I need to find alternative career for myself. So I went happily. So that's why I know I you know what I mean is, I'm not only a Gorkha, I not only did serve in the army, in the British army, but I lived as a Gorkha. So it's in me, it's in my society. So I know the inside out. That's why the book has become so authentic and real, because it tells the actual story of the Gorkha. So it was very important and well received by everybody.
And you were a corporal.
Yeah, I was a corporal.
Yeah. I was a lance corporal.
Okay.
So now we have to call each other corporal, lance corporal. Can Tim, for our friends at home, can you tell us what is life like in Nepal? Obviously, it's very different depending on where you live. But what is a typical life for a young man who might be thinking of or might wish to join the Gurkhas?
No, I think I cannot talk about the situation at the moment, because I have came out of Nepal and I've been out of Nepal for a long time, you know, almost 40 years. I've been out of Nepal, but what I can talk about is the time, you know, my time when I was in Nepal. At the time, it was 1970s. As I said before, we had villages just from 1 or 2 hours from Pokhara. You know, the Pokhara is a small town, was a small town where the British Army came situated for the recruitment purposes, and it is still there even today. And that time Pokhara was not very big, and we lived in a village just a few hours from there, walking from there. But in our village, as I said, life was, everybody was farming. We were farmers, and everybody, you know, we were a very closely knitted family, you know, people, villagers living in a village, mostly, you know, descendant from one couple. So we all share the same grandfather, one ancestor. So we're all related, like a father, uncle, sister, like that. So when you see your grandfather, fathers, uncles, everybody going, join the army, and coming back with nice clothes, a little bit nice clothes, and some, a little bit more money, then it was actually a typical Gurung village, you know, so a Gorkha village. So we actually didn't see anything at all other than joining the British Army. Of course, we had choice, three choices at the time. The first actually in our village, we just had two choices. The first was the British Army, always the priority one. And second was the, if we fail in joining the British Army, then we would choose for the Indian Army. There's another choice for the Nepal Army, but I don't know why people from our village never almost never went there. So only thing we saw was you know, British Army. So no matter what do, end of the day, you know, when you are big enough to have a growing up, you know, you have a, you are tall enough, that was 5.2 inches, and you can the weight was 50 kilos, and your chest, you know, you can, there was 30 and 32 inches. So without you know, spread, it was 30 inches. After you spread, 32 inches. So once you got that level, you go and line up. That was the only thing, you know. So also, there was even the our family, like you know, the sister, the daughter's sister or our aunties, everybody, you know, the first priority was, you know, was to marry a Gurkha. That was the reality in our time, and we had no other option. We thought no other option whatsoever at that time. So as you can see, I was quite a bright student in my school, and still I joined the army because of that. And I also had two reasons. One was I was the first son of the family. Second was my father was in the army, in the Gurkha army, Gurkha. So we were in comparison, not that well off in financially. So it was the honest, the responsibility was on me as a first son of the family to join the army. So that's the only thing we could see, nothing at all. Like a blinker, how a horse, you know, you just see it, nothing at all. So it wasn't like that, you know. But I think things have changed a lot now, because now they the Nepal has improved a bit. You have internet everywhere, you have road going, you know, at least the unpaved road has been everywhere. And coming in, most of them, because of the Mao's insurgency in 1980s, late 90s, people had to flee from the village and go to the town area to be safe. So people come to Pokhara and all the other cities and they live there. So now I think life has changed a lot. Also, they have other options going to other countries. At the same time, I don't think, and I have been out of Nepal for 40 years, so maybe I'm not qualified to talk in.
Yes, I remember reading a long time ago, we're talking about 30 years ago now, about the recruitment process in Nepal. And you had a British Army officer would walk from village to village. Or, and I'm probably getting this a bit wrong, it was a long time ago, but these young men would come forward and their dream was to be a Gurkha, and they would have some criteria. So I think you mentioned it, the chest would have to expand a certain amount of inches.
They'd 30 to 32 inches, yeah.
Yes, they'd have to do the physical stuff and carry a basket across a route march, and some of these young men, they would walk for days to get to the recruitment post. Does this sound about right?
No, actually, at the early time, it wasn't the British officer. The British officer, they normally stay in the recruitment center. There was normally there was one in West Nepal, like Pokhara, my hometown. There is another one in Dharan, in Eastern Nepal. What they used to do normally was that there was those ex-Gurkhas, you know, who have served in the British Army, retired, and they're, you know, mostly a senior ranking officer, like a non-commissioned officer, not the commissioner, not the officer, but the non-commissioned officer, like sergeant or a W2 or even lieutenant, like that. They used to call them a Gullawal.
Yeah.
So they are appointed by the British recruitment office in Pokhara in Nepal, and they went around and then for certain areas. So they are located in certain area. They go there and select the best one, and normally they will select all of them. Then accordingly, bring it to the final recruitment camp like Pokhara. Then where we used to have a lot of tests, like all the fitness tests, running tests, medical tests, education tests, those kinds of normal things. And they would mark the numbers and then select the best one. That was in our time. Later on, nowadays, I think since the number of recruitment for the British Army has gone down significantly down, it's just 200 or 150 or 250 maximum a year. Before it was a few hundred, even a thousand a year. But at the moment, it's probably a few hundred. I think it's 250 maximum, like that. So what they do is normally they all come to Pokhara. They also have in Dharan, they have a very small one. They also bring from there. They come to Nepal, Pokhara. Everybody go there. And they call it, like we said, in the basket, we call it, they call it the doko race. Doko race. Doko means it's a rattan, you know, kind of, it's a bamboo basket to carry things. And they put a weight as something like, I don't know, maybe 30, 60, I don't know, kilo, something like that. Then make them run for a certain period of distance. Then whoever are going up the hill and whoever come first, they win, you know, because the competition is probably very tough. Probably 10,000, 20,000, even 30, 40,000 before. Now probably 10, 20,000 just for 200. So that's the case now. But before, it was like you said, the Gallawala used to go all around the villages, collect his men, all the young guys, and bring it to the recruitment center and do the test again and select the best one.
Mm.
That was the case.
Is it in Nepal? I'm guessing it's a rural lifestyle, a lot of farming. There's a lot of hills or mountains. So the young men are probably quite strong anyway. It must mean that the guys that get through the recruitment process are really, really, really quite fit.
They have to be fit, of course, because they have to win the doko race, you know, the carrying a basket race and come up the hill. But at the same time, what has changed now, because they live in those Gurkhas also live in the UK now. They serve in the UK now. And they have to go other country like Afghanistan, Brunei, Singapore, or whatever. They have to go, wherever they have to go, right? In that case, they have to be also well educated. So what they do now is, I think it's a combination of both. So they have to be well educated, also be fit. And so you become not only, you know, if you only select from those from the hill, you know, they might be strong, but they won't be able to survive in a civilized country society like London. So I think it's combination both. That's why I saw in Nepal when I was going there visiting for my books, research for my book, they have created a lot of training school, you know, the physical school, where those people will train those youngsters for the British Army, you know. So they train there. They know what is required, what those requirements. They train there. Then they already are well educated. Most of them are university students. So they train there for a year or two. Then they are educated. They train. They are physically fit, and they go there. I think that's the only case now, because also most of the people in Nepal now live in those cities or some small towns. You know, they don't live mostly in the village. Only those very poor and very old people live in the village nowadays. So that is the case now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's it like, Tim, arriving in England or the United Kingdom for the first time?
Nowadays or before?
Your experience, was it very different?
No, for me it's not a big difference, but for of course it was a big difference. The culture shock, everything was there. But my biggest, I lived there in Sandhurst for a year. I didn't live that much. I lived there for a year in Sandhurst. You know, the British officer training center.
Mm.
We lived there. I lived there as a, I served there for a year. My biggest problem was the winter, you know, the cold. The other was not a problem at all. It was the coldness. It was too cold for us. Especially when we were deployed in the jungle, you know, there was all the snow everywhere, and it was too cold for us. That's the only problem. But nowadays, I think because of the internet, yes, the people, they know, and the young generation, they know most of the thing. Also, the non-Nepali youth goes everywhere, all over the world, so it shouldn't be that much. There must travel for them.
Yes, it's a changing world, of course, and also technology and the internet brings everything closer to home. Was it difficult to learn the language? I worked with the Gurkhas. I did two parachute courses.
Hmm.
And on each course, there was about maybe about a third, if not 50%, were Gurkhas. And it's quite incredible because learning to parachute is difficult enough. It's a life or death situation. If you get it wrong, it's going to be death. But of course, we're learning in English, and we're English guys, you know, English or British guys or Commonwealth guys. I say guys, there were no girls on either of the courses I did. But for these young men from Nepal, they're having to learn all these difficult drills, but in a foreign language that maybe they've only had a year, 2 years to learn. Was that difficult to learn English so quickly, or does everybody learn it?
No, I don't think so, because especially in during my time, most of the Gurkhas, they didn't speak very well English, and didn't speak good English, because it was almost impossible, because all the lesson we had to take was in Nepalese, in Gurkhalese, and English was only for reading. So there also, we always live with our own people. And as you know, the Gurkha, the British officer, were only there for the show. They come and bark the order and then disappear, you know, most of the time. So we had to live with our own people. So we speak Nepali. So for most of them, the English learning is, there wasn't a chance necessity to learn English at the moment. But at the moment, nowadays, they live in the UK, I think they also have to be quite good at English. That's why when they recruit the Gurkhas from Nepal, I think that's why they look for the university graduates. Some of them, they already go to the basic English school in Nepal. And some of them, they even study in other, like Singapore or Hong Kong or even in UK. So they shouldn't have a problem for English. I think now the modern one, all the new soldiers, they have no problem in it.
Tim, what rank can a Gurkha get to? Because I saw there was a Gurkha colonel, and I didn't know you could become a colonel as a Gurkha. I always thought that was the British officer's job.
I think when the Gurkhas moved from India to Malaysia and Singapore, instead of integrating the Gurkhas into the British Army, as stipulated in the treaty, they signed a treaty in 1947 called the Tripartite Treaty between the British, Gurkha, Nepal, and India. They created a completely separate system for the Gurkhas. So because of that, we had a different system, we had a different rule of laws, we had different pay, different pension, everything was different. So within our time, when I was still there, a Gurkha can only promote to a major. It's a Gurkha major. That's not even a commission officer. It's a Gurkha major. So you have to go through a lance corporal sergeant, like that, you know, from the ground, then climb up to the Gurkha major. So Gurkha major was the most senior officer in a battalion who was responsible for an administrative job or welfare of the Gurkha soldiers and their family. And also assistant to a colonel who was the commanding officer of the British, who was, of course, always a British army. And during that time, there were just few of the, you know, very highly educated Gurkhas were allowed to join the attend the Sanders British Commissioning Corps. There's just four or five of them who eventually became a lieutenant colonel. Even they, you know, the highest rank they could do was a lieutenant colonel. But after the Gurkhas left Hong Kong in 1997 and become part of the British Army, I think they have changed the rule now, and the Gurkhas were also allowed to get promoted beyond colonel. That's why I think you have some of them. I think we have four or five of them now. That's the main reason. But before that, we had no, there was no, nothing at all. And you know, the most amazing thing, you know, I was, actually it was the irony or the saddest thing. It was, you know, the Gurkha major, you know, the most senior Gurkha officer in a battalion with at least 20 years of service had to salute a second lieutenant, a British guy, who was at the age of, he's even younger than his son. That was the, you know, acrimony, you know, the disparity between the British and British and the Gurkha. And that is the reason why we are still having this discrimination and having this problem. I think you are aware of the hungry strike going on in London, Whitehall, you know, opposite of the British Prime Minister's office. That's the reason, you know, that's the main reason why this is still going on. And what I want to tell you is, you know, that the Gurkhas, like I said at the beginning, Gurkhas have always been a good friend and loyal friend for the British, for over to an institution that lasted for over 200 years, cannot survive on loyalty alone and bravery alone. There must be something more. And I think after my research and reading the book, you know, our country has given everything they had, everything, even today, everything. But in when you treated the British, I'm not saying the British people as a German. British people love their Joni Gurkhas. That's no doubt about it. It is the policy, the British government policy. That's disgusting. Okay. So for the last 200 years, we gave everything. We treated like our true friend. You know, we, the Gurkhas, you know, they did their part. But in return, I think what the British government did or doing to us is disgraceful. So I think those who read my book will understand why I'm saying this. But that is the reason, you know, because as you know, as I said, after 1947, they created a completely different separate system, paid 10 times less than the British counterpart, doing the same job, carrying the same rifle, and facing the same bullet. And you know how many Gurkhas have died. And the implication this institution has inflicted into the Nepal is actually massive. The problem is, until now, I don't know why nobody has ever looked into it, researched into it, and written into it. Nobody did until now. But you know, the reason why Nepal is still one of the poorest countries in the world is because of this Gurkha. That's the main reason. And you know, all the even the First World War, Second World War, there's so many Gurkhas died. They went home, and you know, until they in Malaysia, they for 10 years the communist guerrilla in Malaysia, then they fought the Indonesian in Borneo confrontation, and also they fought in Falkland, Kosovo, Bosnia, Iraq, Afghanistan, everywhere, right? But in return, what do we get? Nothing. That was, I think, that was everything was okay until the Gurkhas, when the Gurkhas were still in Nepal. That was still acceptable because the living standard in Nepal was low. The money, whatever we give, we can earn and we can get from the British Army was quite good when we were in Nepal. Then we could at least live a dignified and decent life with that pension. But when the campaign began, the Gurkha Justice campaign began, and they moved to the UK in 2009. And then the real problem begins there, because you are living in the UK as a British citizen, you're paying the same, you have to pay the same for water, electricity, and other bills and living standards. But it's, you're still getting the Nepali pension, then how can you expect them to survive? That was the biggest problem. And if the British were a little bit sensible and give them the equal pension, and most of them would have, you know, moved back to Nepal and have a very comfortable and simple life. And, you know, in a foreign country, like those old guys who don't speak English, they don't know about the living, the way of living there. They don't know about the culture there. And they don't speak English. How can you expect them to survive? It's very hard for them. And I think it's pretty shameful that the British still treat our people like garbage. And I feel very bad about that. And sorry, I have to say this here, but...
Hey, Tim, the British government treat the British people like rubbish. You're not alone, brother, but I do understand. I spoke to the two Gurkhas and the Gurkha wife on hunger strike yesterday, and yes, what can we say? It's not just you guys. The British government hate veterans anyway. we're nothing to them. They work for other people.
Big corporation.
Yeah. The trillion-dollar corporations controls our government. Our government are just puppets.
Mm.
But they believe that they're a bit special. So they hate the people. They think we're scum.
Mm.
And that we won't, you know, we won't rise up. But
it's
I think that...
Actually, yeah.
It's sorry to get political, folks, but it has to be said. Life has become a joke in this country, and I don't care about me and because I'm an old guy, but I care about the children and what their future is. And if we just keep allowing this disrespect, this segregation, this manipulation and control to happen, well, it's not going to go to a good place, because these guys play their own game. They don't care about us.
No.
But fortunately, through podcasts like this, people are slowly becoming aware of this, Tim. Mm-hmm. And I hope it, you know, I hope it's all well. I'm going to do my best to make sure it goes to a better place. But mm-hmm. I'm one guy. Let's talk, because let's talk about the Gurkha's commitment, because did I read in World War One there was 200,000 Gurkhas, and yet in Nepal there's only five million people? So
one in ten didn't return home.
Yes, one in ten didn't return home, but of course many return home injured.
Mentally broken.
Yeah, broken, damaged, blind, maybe lost their legs, arms, and yet they can't go back to work on their farms, their homeland.
Yeah.
So the wife then has to look after them.
Yeah.
And also, did I understand that people then would like have hate for that family? Did I understand that? Or for the wife who lost her husband?
I think that's a completely different thing. But at the same time, at that time, there were so many of them, and they were so, you know, overwhelmed by the war that and sorrow and the misery that they simply had no time to think the hate or hatred or the bitterness to other people. They were too engrossed, you know, overwhelmed by their own problems. So they just try to survive as a used up and thrown away garbage, you know. And you know how they are paid. There was one I also written in the book. It was in World War II, when at that time the Nepal had only 6 million people, and 250,000 people grabbing from the village, sent by the even the prisoners, everybody, then we grab them and put on the truck and then send them to war. Then 33,000 die, and many of them were injured, you know, like I said. But you know, when they went back home, they were sent, given a pocket money, a few hundred Indian rupees by then, and a white piece of cloth that was 1 or 2 meters, something like that. White piece of cloth. I don't know why they give it, because in Nepal, white piece of cloth is actually an insult, because it's a pall that you use for the dead one. White piece of cloth is a pall that you use for the dead people. So I don't know whose idea was or how, whose idea was that, but that was, I just couldn't believe when I found it out, you know. But one thing I have to say now here is that I know how the British did that, because they wanted to pay as less as possible. But if the Nepal government and our rulers were not in collusion with the British, it would have never happened. So, because I am not here to blame anyone. So I'm just here to tell the truth. So as a founder, so our Nepali leaders are also as blamed, can must be as guilty as the British policy. Mm-hmm. If they hadn't, they were not complicit with the crime, you know, it would have never happened, because they had a very weak knees for the British to be a friend with the British. Actually, by that time, even today, to be a friend with the British guy, big guy, with a lot of embellishment and star all over his uniform, and take a picture with them was an honor for them, you know. Even today, and I doing my research, I found whenever the British needed more people, they used to send a general or some big guy with a lot of star all over his place, and talk with the Nepali leader and take a picture. And the Nepali would just collapse, and they would just say yes to everything, you know, even today. That's the case, you know. And there's another thing is, you know, that's funny that it was so sad, but it's also funny that in return for that, in both World War One and World War Two, and also in the after the Borneo confrontation in 1989 and also 1969 and 1994. Whenever the British needed the more people, they got it. Then they, after the incident is over, they sent back to them home. And what they did is, in return for the favor, as a favor, they give all those, you know, the honorary ranks, you know, like knighthood or the general colonel of the regiment, all those things. To Nepali leader, because it cost them nothing.
Yes.
It was so funny, but this is so horrible, terrible.
Tim, from my experience, Gurkhas are incredibly loyal. They're incredibly friendly. They just love to learn and to talk. They love dancing. I love dancing, but so full of life. But what is it that, how come they're so fearless? What is that, for the loyalty, or is that something to do with Nepalese culture?
I think there's a lot of things, but I'm not a psychologist. But I think it's one is a commitment to what you do, give your best. Because in our culture, whenever somebody give you a job, you do your best, because you respect the guy who give you a job. That's one thing. And the other thing is the upbringing, you know, that you have to give your best, do your best to your master. And third is, I think, is it's also the Gorkha, they don't like serious stuff. They just want to play around and joke around and do their job and go home and drink, party like that, you know. And another thing, the most important thing is, I think, is the there one is the most important thing is they don't, as I said, they don't like the serious stuff. So they don't know how the world is. They know they don't care how the whole world, how people manipulate, how people take advantage of you, how people use you, thing like that, you know, and for interest, people do anything and thing. And then they are very easy to, they also are, they have also, they're very, they have perseverance skill, they have tenacity, also adaptation, they have everything. And, but also, the, I think, is also the stupidity, you know, that that also plays a part. I'm sorry to say that, but that also plays a part. That's why how they, you know, they don't fear or they go and die, you know? They're ready to die for the, I think that's another thing. And they are also easily, you know, manipulated. They can be easily manipulated. That's another reason, yeah.
Yes, of course. What, Tim, tell us about the swimming, because Nepal is a landlocked country. Obviously, you have many rivers, but I gather that the many Gurkhas have to learn to swim.
Yeah, I think that's the reason, because Nepal is a landlocked country. There's not much river. There's no swimming pool, obviously, in the village. So in the river, because the place is so hilly, you know, mountainous, so there is no pond or swimming place to learn swimming. So there's no river. Only rivers are, you know, just very, very steep. So most of them, they almost never swim, especially during our time. We didn't swim. We just walk on the river, never learned to swim. So we had to learn swimming when in the regular training. But nowadays, I think they have some swimming pool in those cities area, so they should be able to swim. I think nowadays it should be different story.
And you know who is Nim's Dai?
Yeah, I know the guy. Yeah,
he was Gurkha, joined the SBS, so he had to swim really well. Yeah. And then, for friends listening, Nim's Dai has been on the podcast.
Yeah.
He climbed the world's 14 highest peaks.
Yeah.
In record time. The previous record was 8 years, and Nim's Dai in his with just his Sherpa team, so all Nepalese, climbed in 6 months. I bet the country is very proud of them. Do you think so, Tim? Nepal is very proud of what Nim's Dai has done?
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of people know them. But Nepal, like I said, Nepal has a lot of issues. You know, their way of thinking, way of life is a little bit different than what we do in mostly in Western country, because we have this caste system, we have this social problems, we have this political system, we have this religious system problems. They have a lot of problems because of this, and people have rather narrow minded, and they're short-sightedness, you know. And as I said, I think they still have to grab the importance of being famous or brightening, you're making your name popular around the world, in the world space. They still have to grab things. At the same time, we have a lot of fighting going on in Nepal because of this, this mainly because of the religion and caste system. Because of that, you know, you have people think that the thinking is a little bit different, so they still have to come they still have to unite as a national team, and in that sense, I think it's still lacking. So I think they still have a lot to learn before they start appreciating those kind of great work done by our Nepalese people.
Yes, of course. Infighting, I always call it divide and conquer. You know, you get the people arguing with each other, and then they don't see how they're being controlled.
Yeah, they are more busy on personal interests while missing the big picture. That's the
yes,
biggest problem.
Exactly. Yeah. Tim, we should talk about battle honors, famous battles. Can you? I just don't want to finish the podcast without talking about the huge commitment that the Gurkhas have put in. I mean, on the back of your book, it says it all. I mean, we First World War, Second World War, Malaya, Singapore, Borneo, East Timor, Hong Kong, Cyprus, Falklands, Iraq, Afghanistan, Kosovo. There's a massive commitment there. Can you give us some ideas of maybe some incidents that have taken place in some of these wars? Maybe some, I don't know, like honors that the Gurkhas have won?
Yeah, I think, as you know, the Gurkhas started joining the British Army in the middle of Anglo-Gurkha War. That did happen in two phases, and 1814 and 1816. Then when the British fought the Gurkhas in a small hill on the first phase of the First World War, the Anglo-Gurkha War, there was just about 600 men, including wife and children, and the British had almost 22,000. People with advanced artillery weapon like that, and they were so impressed by the bravery and the tenacity of the Gurkhas. You know, they decided right away on the spot that you should better be on my side than fight with me. That's why they started in 1815 with 5,000 men, with three Gurkha battalions, and they played a significant role from 1815 to 1947 to establish the British Raj in India. And they fought all those main wars, like the Maratha Wars, the Jats War, the 2-6 Wars, Afghanistan War, and Burmese War, like that, you know. But it was in the Sepoy, you know, the Indian Mutiny in 1857 and 58, when the first, second battalion, Gurkhas called the Simur Battalion, 327 men die out of 498.
They got overrun.
They were surrounded by all the mobs and killed everyone. They still fought on, and they won that. From there on, only from there on, the Gurkhas were given the rank of soldiers from that Sepoy mutiny. And during the Sepoy mutiny, not only the Gurkhas fought alongside the British, but also the Nepal army sent around 9,000 to 15,000 Nepalese army from the hill down, coming down and taking down all the mutineers along the way, then saved the British. Otherwise, the British Raj would have been, finished in 1857. It started from there. Then there was not even a single war since then, there wasn't the Gurkhas fighting alongside the British. But as I said, in First World War, more than 200,000 people came down to fight for the British. They came to Europe and they fought in the Middle East and Africa. And in Second World War, they came to Europe, also fought in Middle East and Africa. You know, the British, the German general was defeated in Africa because by the British, by the Gurkhas. And they also fought in Burma, which was the biggest war, that they fought. And there were so many people died. Then all together, the British won 13 VCs, the Victoria Cross. In their
13 VCs.
VCs, 13 VCs, 2 in First World War, 12, 10 in Second World War, 1 in Borneo Confederation. And the living VC, Ram Bahadur Poon, he is still in Kathmandu today. He's still alive today. He's the only living VC, VC in Germany. Because the VC, if the VC was only allowed, only allowed, permitted to be given to the Gorkhas in 1911, because before that, it wasn't allowed. So you can imagine if it was allowed before, it could have been many more. So and then, as you know, in the therefore in Malaysia, Borneo Confederation, in Falkland War, in Kosovo, even Afghanistan altogether. And now in Afghanistan, I think from 2001 to 2014, 12 Gurkhas were killed and 16 were injured. And after that, I don't know, because I didn't find the research from then on. So for 206 years, it's like, and you should remember one thing is Nepal wasn't and isn't even a colony of Nepal, a colony of British, It's a separate sovereign country. And you just go there like a, and it's like a tap water. You go there and you open the tap and take the water on whatever water you need, and you close it and come back. Every year go there in somebody's country, take the best men of their, cream of their youth, and make them fight for your country. And in return, you treat them like a trash. So,
yes.
Yeah.
We need to stop war. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I like love. Love and friendship is the best way, I think. What, Tim, in the Falklands, were the Gurkhas angry? They didn't, am I correct? They didn't get to fight a battle? Not their fault, but they weren't ordered into battle?
I think it's all the British propaganda machine. I don't think that is the case, because like as you say, when before the Falkland War, when the Gurkhas was to fight with the Argentine, the British propaganda machine used the propaganda paper, and they keep distributing millions of propaganda papers saying that Gurkhas are like a beast, blood sucking beast. They take out the kukri, then without sucking or killing somebody and sucking the blood, they won't put it down. Things like that, they are your supposed to be your friend, your brother on arms. You don't say those things. You don't insult those things. And this is that's why the Argentinian went away and surrendered. That's the reason they won the way. But
yeah,
that's not the way to treat your own people, brother or not. So there was all confused about the propaganda thing.
So that was propaganda.
Propaganda. There's nothing to do with the Gurkha. You they're talking like the Gurkhas are not like a machine, without blood or feeling or thinking mind or nothing. It's like a blood machine. You just go there and kill and come back and dance and thing like that. We are also human.
Tim, we all understand that, but I think it's a bit of maybe military folk tale that allegedly some of the Argentines believe if the Gurkhas get you, they're going to eat you, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But it's actually not about, that's a fearsome reputation. So it's not.
That's what the British has done from the beginning. It's only about bravery, but never talk about their tragedy, never talk about their feeling, never talk about their welfare, never talk about their family, never talk about their life. That was the problem.
Yes, of course. Of course. This is why so many people have been fighting for the Gurkhas' rights
Exactly.
Over the years. And Britain is a people won't like to hear this, but historically we've been in, well, it goes both ways, but we have been quite a racist nation.
Yeah.
It still continues today, and you see it, you see hints of it. I mean, I grew up in the 70s. It was a very, it was an incredibly racist time, much different to young people today. We were led to believe we were superior to other countries and other colors. And it's a horrible thing that I have to live with that. I have to live with that's how I was programmed when I was a kid, by sort of cultural influences, by comedy and not comedy, but by humor. We made fun of everybody, but
yeah, exactly. Even the Gurkha Patan, you know, look, the British officer, they had the same attitude, same behavior, same activity. They did the same, separated. There was a two different system.
Yes, and the irony is when I look at the world now, and then I look at the way that tribes live. You know, Nepal is a tribal country. It's those guys have got it right. They have family, community, honor, simplicity. They don't destroy the planet.
Yeah.
You know, they have it all right. The way that the West is going, or the globe now, it's toxic. It everything is so wrong.
It's poison. Yeah.
You know, all this nonsense.
Yeah.
It's just so, I'd rather be, you know, in a Nepalese house drinking some whiskey, dancing around the fire, telling stories, than spending an evening just watching rubbish on my phone or pretending that people like me when they probably don't even care about me. So can we talk about the do I say it right? Kukri?
Kukri, yeah, Kukri.
Kukri, the legendary.
In Nepal, we said it's Kukri.
Kukri.
Yeah, Kukri.
And each one is handmade by a blacksmith, by a craftsman.
Yeah, mostly it was the case. There was a craftsmen around those Gurkhas area. Also, some of the Gurkha battalions during the World War II, they even produced by themselves. We found that, yeah.
Yes, I mean, everybody wants a kukri. They're a special tool. I'm going to call it a tool, not a weapon, but I guess it's both.
The famous knife, yeah.
Yeah, the famous knife. And okay, I'm going to put some questions to you, Tim. Maybe some are silly. I don't know, but this is stuff I've grown up with, but hearing about the Gurkhas. Every time you draw the kukri, you have to draw blood. I think this is nonsense, but
it is bullshit, yeah.
I knew it was. Is it true it's sharp enough that you can cut the head off a cow? It's I saw some photo years ago.
Some of them you can, because it is a little bit bigger, because in Nepal they have this bigger and longer sacrificial knife.
Yeah.
It's a kukri, but it's bigger. So they use normally for the sacrificing the animals. Some of them can. Yeah.
And I've been seeing a story on the media. Gurkha, did he take out 30 Taliban in Afghanistan? Is this a true story? Or apparently they were surrounded and he just picked up every weapon and emptied every magazine. I haven't really read too much about it, but I...
No, there is a one guy called... the guy from the Gurkhas. Yeah, he took out 17 or something Talibans with one machine gun. That's real story. I think he won the GCB, you know, the Gallantry Award.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. But there is another story. The one Gurkha, that's an Indian Gurkha, he took out 30 bandits alone with a kukri. That happened in a Indian train when he was going home. There were some bandits tried to loot, tried to rob the passenger. And the guy with the khukri who was going home on leave, long leave, then he single-handedly chased them all them away. That's also true.
Hey, Tim, I live in Plymouth. That's a normal day for us.
Yeah.
Every time we go outside the front door.
Yeah.
Tim, listen, this has been a fascinating chat. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really hope we can meet in Hong Kong at some point. I don't know when I'm back in Hong Kong, but it would be nice to come over.
Yeah, that would be my pleasure, and thank you very much for everything.
Yes, and I wish you so much luck with the book.
Yeah,
friends at home.
I have a book.
Yeah,
yeah, book time again. Yeah.
We're going to put links for the books, friends, below the video on YouTube. So grab a copy. It's an incredible read. It's just so fascinating. There's so much stuff here that you're probably not going to hear in books that are maybe written by British officers. Or
yeah, this is the other side of the story. Then
yeah, the other side of the story.
Your perception about the Gurkhas will change after reading this book.
Yeah. And it's a very nicely flowing read. You start reading and you can't put it down, folks. So grab a copy. Tim, just stay there when I hit off the record button so I can thank you properly. But can I say Ayo Gurkhali?
Yeah, Ayo Gurkhali. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you so much. It was my honor.
Yeah, no, the honor is all of ours, and I wish you all the Gurkhas and the people in Nepal all the best for the future. To our friends at home, I hope you've enjoyed this as much as I have. If you can like and subscribe and share this video, that will really help our channel. Much love to you all. Look after yourselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.